welcome to the Cure for Chronic Pain podcast with me, Nicole Sachs. You are here. Hello, my favorite people. How are you today? This is Nicole, and you've reached my podcast, The Cure for Chronic Pain with me, Nicole Sachs. So glad to be with you today. So excited to share this interview with you. One of the most comprehensive and most articulate TMS interviews I have had in a while with my dear friend, Catherine Oxenberg. So what's interesting about this world we live in, this globe that spins, that we're all just hanging on to for dear life, is that weird shit happens all the time. And when I used to sit on my bedroom floor during the pandemic and fold laundry and live my best pandemic life, one of my guilty pleasures was watching the HBO series The Vow. And I really I love sort of true crimey cult documentaries. I love a documentary that reveals a villain for who they are and punishes a person for wrongdoing. I'm very, very into justice and what's right and wrong. And what I loved about The Vow is that in the first episode of The Vow, you find out that Keith Raniere goes to jail for like over 100 years. So I don't have to spend the whole documentary wondering if this guy ever gets his punishment that he deserves. Having said that, I was very into it. I actually watched the whole thing through twice. And I was fascinated by Catherine Oxenberg, this freaking amazing woman who was dedicated. Her life was literally dedicated to deprogramming her precious daughter, India, and getting her out of this cult. And as a mother of three teenagers, you know, one of whom is in her 20s, like, it's just the thought of having a child and you don't have power over a child once they turn 18. You can't force them to do anything. And having a child in jeopardy like that and not being able to do anything, you know, easily and just the whole thing. If you've seen The Vow, you know. If you haven't, it's available on HBO. But in any case, Catherine Oxenberg was a shining example of not giving up. And she had a very triumphant ending. She did get India out of the cult, spoiler alert. And India is doing amazing today. And India and Catherine are so close. And I know them both. And anyway, so the way the world spins, Catherine found me after suffering profoundly with terrible chronic fibromyalgia and nerve pain and all over body pain after India was safe. And any of you guys out there who know the way this rolls, when somebody finally reaches safety, when the nervous system switches into what should be rest and repair, if there are feelings, if there are repressed emotions or stored trauma that needs to be felt, and we don't know how to feel it properly, which is what I'm always teaching here, it is going to be expressed through the body in some way, shape, or form. And Catherine had no idea, but she learned. And then once she came to understand mind-body medicine, once she came to understand my work and other healing modalities, she really started to improve. And today, Catherine is totally free. Totally free. She's amazing. She's starting her own website and she has a foundation helping people with PTSD like India and other women out there. I had no idea, but Catherine helped me understand during this interview that actually women are the largest group in this country suffering from PTSD. It's so commonly associated with war veterans, not that I take away 1% of anyone's PTSD from war. It's so absolutely profoundly horrible for me to think about people witnessing war. But there are also women out there who have so many everyday experiences that are totally traumatic, and this is a group that is largely unnoticed. And so Catherine's really out there fighting the good fight for these women and bringing resources to them. So anyway, it's an amazing interview. Amazing, amazing. I love the way we all walk through this earth and then like we bump into each other. We connect with each other. We get opportunities to help and soothe and find and support one another. And it's just beautiful for me and I love it. So so you will really enjoy this interview. Not much housekeeping today. Just want to remind you that the training that I have created with Christina Sarno is launching soon. Please stay tuned to my website, thecureforchronicpain.com, for all information on the training and how to sign up. It is a practitioner training, but also a training for anyone who is interested in carrying this message to their communities, to their classrooms, to their families. We've worked so hard on it and I'm incredibly proud of it. So please stay tuned to my website for more information on that. And if you'd like my support, my personal support, answering your questions, connecting with you on Zoom every month, two live meetings and an all month, every day online community, go to my website, thecureforchronicpain.com, and join my membership community. You just scroll down a little bit on the homepage and you'll see the button to join. We're having an incredible time over there. And if you really want my personal attention, so many people are emailing me, that is the way to do it. All right, my loves. So glad to be here with you today. Enjoy this incredible talk with Catherine Oxenberg. Hi, everyone. Today I'm here with Catherine Oxenberg. Welcome, Catherine.
Hi, Nicole. What a pleasure.
What a pleasure. So, Catherine, you and I have an interesting history. So I'm just going to go into it a touch on my end, and then I'm going to open it up to your story because I'm really excited to hear it in the detail with which you tell it. And I'm also excited to hear it again because it's been a couple of years since we've had this conversation in detail. So during COVID, one of my great guilty pleasures was watching The Vow. And I really, and it's so funny, in the rear view, when I look at anything that means something to me, I can always find these interesting touch points where it's bringing me somewhere. You know, that's my sort of my spiritual lens. But I can't say I was obsessed with it. I was so fascinated by the human aspect of The Vow and of cults and of the way that it was told in such a human way. And I actually ended up watching it twice all the way through. And I know. And as I was watching it, one of my greatest connections was with Catherine Oxenberg. It was so weird. Like, I know I didn't know you at the time, but mother to mother, because I have children who are now 20, 18, and 15. I just was like, just admired so much your bravery. And I know it's TV and I know it's edited and I know they didn't show every second of you know, your lows and whatever, but just the way that you moved through that experience. Anyway, so I just had this like pre-knowing you experience with you, which I have to say is hilarious because it's what most people have with me. You know, someone will meet me and they'll say, "Oh my God, I already know you. I know everything about you. We could be best friends." Like, yeah, okay. I'm sure you are feeling the same as I say this. But anyway, so when it was probably about a year after, maybe it's still within the pandemic, I get a direct message on Instagram from Catherine Oxenberg. And I'm like, no fucking way. And she had reached out to say that she was interested in my work, doing my work. I think you had just finished reading my book at the time. Yes. And so so we started talking and she started explaining to me what had befallen her after India was released from that cult situation, which is to me so typical of TMS. You know, we're in fight or flight. We're desperately trying to get ourselves to survive essentially through a situation, whether it be familial, like Catherine was going through, or personal, or whatever it is. We're in fight or flight. But when the fight or flight starts to ease, the nervous system is so dysregulated and it's so up to here that oftentimes that leaves us as fertile ground for TMS. And I know Catherine had a bunch of it. And I know that she's done incredible work and is in a very different place right now. So Catherine, let me just open it up to you to kind of start wherever that inspires you to start and share your story with us just a bit.
Well, thank you. It's such an incredible pleasure to speak with somebody who understands TMS. Mm-hmm. Because mostly I'm talking to people who look at me as if I'm speaking a foreign language, and that's lonely. So yes, I guess there's two parts to the story. One is the post-cult. And interestingly enough, my symptoms didn't surface until not after he'd been arrested, the cult leader, not after he was sentenced, but when once he was sent to his place of incarceration for a, sorry, I have a kitty that's meowing. That's okay. For 120 years. So right. My little girl, who was never able to say no when stuff happened to me when I was little, I lost my voice. When my daughter was in jeopardy, that part of me surfaced, this primal maternal kind of power that I didn't know that I had to fight for her. I was able to use my voice to rescue her and a multitude of other young women who were being abused. But I think my little girl didn't feel safe until he was in prison. He was right. At his final destination. And then literally in a 2-week period in January of 2020, the pain started in my hands and my wrists, and it was bizarre. I mean, it was sharp nerve pain. My fingers were swollen and distended and numb and pins and needles. Then it spread to my wrists. Then it spread to my feet. Then it spread up my body. It was like my whole body
was terrifying.
Fire. I would lie in bed and the pain would wake me up, but it was so fast, this like disintegration from being sort of a healthy, active person. My whole body ended up being on fire, and I was terrified because I was hobbling. I couldn't open jars with my hands. I could barely hold a fork. I'm like, oh my God, either I have some deadly disease or I have MS or I have something.
Of course. How could you not think that?
I was terrified. So the first thing I did was I went to a general practitioner, and he said, I believe your symptoms sound like fibromyalgia. And I had remembered I had had a bout with fibromyalgia back in like 2007. And I was like, God, what's going on that I'm back there? And I said, okay, so what's the consensus? And he said, well, there's medications I can give you, but I don't know how effective they are. And I said, just give me whatever you got. Because at that point, I'm like, okay, I'm in this great new relationship. I have a new life. My house burnt down. The cult is over. The past is the past. And now I'm a cripple. So, you know, really, that's sort of an ironic twist of fate.
Really.
So I started trying different medications, from gabapentin to Cymbalta, like literally. And I think I won't even go into what I think those medications are, you know, designed for, but they're not designed for mind-body issues at all. They just don't work. So I would feel discombobulated. I couldn't drive. I felt like my head was flying off separate from my body. I felt completely disconnected, and I was still in excruciating pain. And at this point, I couldn't lie down. I couldn't get up. I couldn't walk. I felt like I was completely trapped in my body, and I didn't know what to do. And my then boyfriend was like, look, if you don't get this together, I'll send you to the Mayo Clinic. Like, I can't stand seeing you suffer like this. So from the GP, I said, okay, where do I go? So he sent me to a rheumatologist. And tell me if I'm making this too long-winded.
No, it's really important, actually, because people are suffering. And so many people who come to my work are having remarkably similar stories. So feel free to get into as much detail as you'd like.
Okay, thanks. So I went to a rheumatologist. And the first thing, one of my symptoms was insomnia, which actually, since I lost my home in the Woolsey fire, which was back in November of 2000, which was a whole other layer of like trauma, 2018, I hadn't been able to sleep, and I had started taking Ambien. And then I'd weaned myself off, but I was still had terrible insomnia. And he said, well, first he diagnosed me with what's called, I'd never heard, undifferentiated inflammatory arthritis, which means that my blood work was perfect. It was completely normal. So I started feeling like that crazy lady.
Yeah.
The crazy lady who's the hysteric hypochondriac who's just inventing pain. And I'm like, I'm losing my mind. I can't do anything with my life at all. And yet I'm being told that biologically I'm fine. So he gave me this diagnosis because it was pretty obvious. My fingers looked like swollen sausages, and it wasn't from like high sodium intake, and I couldn't move them. And I didn't understand why. And he didn't really reference this, why the pain moved. Yes. So sometimes it would be on the left, sometimes it would be on the right. It wasn't until later that I started to understand that structural pain doesn't move. So, you know, this is again a clue, but I was ignorant as far as.
And I want to just point out here, because it's really important to note, people come to me all the time and they say, do you have a podcast episode that discusses my symptom, whatever it is? And I give them the same answer, which is, I probably do. And the symptom is kind of irrelevant because the way it comes through the body is the way it's being expressed, but it doesn't necessarily matter. One man's migraines is another woman's back pain, is another man's IBS, is another woman's pelvic pain, and on and on and on. Having said that, there is something very powerful, Catherine, to when you can see the physical body change. And the fact that your fingers were actually physically swollen, it's powerful for people to hear, because some people come to me with swelling and they say, well, how can this be TMS? I'm looking at it in my body. And I say, because I've seen it. I had a client once that I was working with one-on-one years ago that had an ankle that was swollen like a baseball was around it. She did the work and it went down. So I just want to use this moment as another example of someone explaining that mind-body issues can actually cause the body to physically swell. It's not just a feeling.
That's fascinating. And I kept looking for causes. Could it have been that fall on the tennis court? Could it have been this? Like, I was insanely trying to make sense of it all. And then, this doctor, he said, in reference to the insomnia, he said, well, what's keeping you up at night? And I was so offended because it was sort of off the cuff. It wasn't like he really cared or was delving into my background or my history or anything. It was just like, well, let's just toss this in. And he's like, okay, I've had a ton of therapy. I've had decades of therapy. And you're just, he seemed so not caring about my pain. And at that point, to be quite honest, if somebody had offered me a psychological process, I probably would have slapped them in the face.
I'm sure.
I just wanted relief. I just wanted somebody to give me a pill to take me out of pain so that I could think straight enough to live my life. And so he gave me another diagnosis and he put me on Plaquenil, and which apparently takes 6 months to work. So I don't even know what the point of that is or if it really does anything. It's like long-winded placebo. But anyway, I took it. So what happened next after that diagnosis? Well, I'd had the diagnosis now of fibromyalgia, of undifferentiated inflammatory arthritis, which I didn't even know was a thing. And I went, I kept bouncing from doctor to doctor because this guy also gave me other meds and they made me feel worse again. And I'm going to tell you, thank God, because if any of these doctors had given me a medication that had actually appeased my pain, and worst of all that I can think of is an opioid, I would be an addict today. I wouldn't have looked any further and I would be completely addicted. So there is a God who just didn't let anything work for me. And this guy actually sent me to a doctor who did neurofeedback. So I started doing neurofeedback because I was desperate. And I would go religiously 3 times a day until COVID, so for months. And I would get relief because whatever the neurofeedback does in the session, it's regulating my brainwaves, or it's upgrading my brainwaves from like dysregulated beta to like to an alpha state, which felt better. But then I would, and he was a lovely guy, and it was $250 a session. Like, I literally, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, that was my life, neurofeedback, and to get a little bit of relief. And he did cognitive behavioral therapy to help me a little bit with the insomnia so that if I couldn't sleep, at least I didn't mind. So he's like, okay. But again, the whole sort of medical direction was, how is Catherine going to manage her pain? Because this is her destiny. And on top of that, what I was told is, well, once the brain is wired for pain, which at the 3-month marker, your brain is going to be wired permanently. And I could hear the ticking clock.
What? They said permanently to you?
Permanently. Yes.
Wow. Permanently.
Which I hear technically is called a nocebo, right? Isn't that the reverse of a placebo? It's like, okay, we're just going to hang this death sentence or terminal cancer diagnosis over your head. Because it's once you get to, and this was in January. So I was thinking, I don't know, 3 months if I can't count, January, February, March, April. Once it got to April, I was doomed. So I was like rushing like a crazy woman, trying to figure out who else I could see, who could help me. Nobody, and everybody's diagnosis was, these these are incurable conditions. There is potential treatment with mediocre kind of results, but really it's about adapting your life to a life of pain management. And there was something in me that just screamed like outrage. There had to be another way. And, you know, that's my MO. If I look at the way I conducted myself when my daughter was drowning in this very dangerous cult, I was told no and no and no over and over again. It's like, you can't, there's nothing you can do. She's a consenting adult. She's over 18, whatever she's doing. And so I just, for me, this was a 24/7 quest to rescue my daughter. And there's something about my personality. It's like, there has to be another way. There has to be another way. And I never really take no for an answer. Like, there's something in me, as down and low as I can get and have gotten throughout my life, that I rise up. I rise up. That's just my pattern. And I go very low, half. But there's something in me that just keeps me going. Thank God. Because throughout that entire year of 2020, so then COVID lockdown and no more neurofeedback.
Right.
And at that point, I found John Sarno.
Yes.
And I read Healing Back Pain. And there was something about that. I'm like, you know what? That makes so much sense. Plus, he talks about Larry David's book Cure, that he read the book and suddenly he threw the book out and had his back pain went away miraculously. And I'm like, I want that. But there was something about what he said, this connection between repressed rage and pain, that clicked.
Yeah.
And I remember having a moment of deep self-compassion for myself, going, wow, it's possible. And you know, Nicole, at that time, I didn't really consider myself that angry of a person. I did tend to attract angry people in my life. From my very childhood, my dad, may he rest in peace, was a bipolar alcoholic. And he was very angry. There were a lot of angry, I grew up around a lot of angry people, but I was not that angry, I didn't think. But I think I may be one of the angriest people on the planet. I think I now renamed myself Rage Girl. So, but the thing about Sarno's book, and God bless him as the pioneer of this incredible work, there weren't enough steps in place in that book for me to be able, that were actionable, that I could then do something about it. The realization was profound. And I actually remember taking the book to the neurofeedback doctor, and I said, do you know about this guy? Like, what do you think of this guy? And he'd never heard of him and didn't know the work. So there again, this disconnect between what's happening, well, how, what treatment looks like today, and what these, you know, these different sort of, I can't think of the word right now, but medical.
I know what you mean. Like the different modalities, like you could go to one kind of therapy or another, or this doctor. Specialist. Yeah.
And ultimately, we need this sort of convergence. These streams need to come together to be able to have this sort of biopsychosocial model of healing that I really, really feel passionate about sharing with other people. Because otherwise, it's like, and I mentioned this before to you, that I had done inner child work. I was bulimic for 20 years, from the age of 16 to 36. So I was in therapy my whole adult life, trying to fix myself, always from the standpoint of, there's something wrong and broken about me, something broken about my body, my mind. And ultimately, inner child work didn't do what it does with your work. And please remember that, because we need to circle back, because I think these are those aha moments where it's like, everything that I did before, sort of nothing has gone to waste. Everything has helped me deepen my recovery at this point. I've been able to sort of reabsorb all of those different therapies that actually work today. So that's what I wanted to mention. So then COVID lockdown, and I'm back at square one in agony. And I start to see doctors on Zoom. And I started to see psychiatrists, and I was diagnosed, continuing diagnoses, I think, with peripheral neuropathy. That was one that made sense, what I've subsequently learned is I have absolutely no nerve damage at all, which is like, thank you, God. Then I was diagnosed with connective tissue disorder. One doctor suggested I was a drug addict, because would explain my symptoms. I was like, okay, thanks.
That's all you need at that moment.
Yes. I was probably prescribed about 20 different medications. And then at one point, a psychiatrist said, well, have you tried ketamine therapy? And I'm like, no, I don't know anything about that. And he said, well, I would put you in a K-hole. So then I researched that a bit in my next session. I'm like, have you put yourself into a K-hole? He said, no, actually, I've never tried the medication. And I hung up the phone. I'm like, I'm never talking to that guy again. But he also gave me more meds, Flexeril and Trazodone, or, you know, if that's the right thing. But more, is, and nothing helped. So then cut to, I got another appointment with a well-known rheumatologist, a lovely woman at UCLA. I had to wait until October. And that whole year, I was just pretty much in bed. There was, the best that I could do was go to the gym at my house and lie on the floor and do an approximation of yin yoga, which is you basically flop an extremity in one direction and leave it there for 15 minutes. And I would just be lying on the floor because moving was too painful. And I wouldn't even call this like a proper stretch, but it was just literally a commitment to just be with my body and be with the pain. And I'll tell you, there was a moment where I was like, I think I'm dying. Like I honestly feel like my body can't take it anymore. And that this pain is almost as if, and I started to see sort of like the chrysalis or a cocoon of a butterfly sort of cracking. And then in this moment of meditation, I had the image in my mind of sort of blue at the core of me, at the heart of me, like, is it possible that I'm dying and being reborn as a butterfly? It's like, and I'm like, is it possible that this physical pain is just my body's way of saying, or my spirit's way of saying, you have outgrown a way of life and you are being reborn to another way of life? And I held on like with a thin thread of hope that that could be possible, as opposed to just that I was dying and my body was just breaking apart and this was the end of me. But there was,
I just have to tell you, I had such a physical reaction when you said that just now. I got chills all over my body because it's just never lost on me the stunning beauty of the awakening that comes in the center of the pain. And it is always a gift. And it's so hard to see that until you're looking at it in the rearview mirror. And time and again, I interview people on this podcast and they say, Nicole, I listened to your podcast and somebody said, I'm grateful for the pain. And I sat in my bed and said, I will never be grateful for this. And now I'm on your podcast saying, I'm grateful for the pain. And it is just the transformation that begins when we lay down our weapons of fear and of blame and of our childhood stories, and we open ourselves through the doorway of the excruciating invitation, and we feel that little center, that kind of that whisper, that soft, small voice, and it says, you're in there somewhere. And it's just, I never skip over the opportunity to call it out, because it's just, it's so much bigger than pain, and it's so beautiful. So anyway, I had to say it, but go on.
No, but thank you. Thank you for that beautiful feedback. And I felt like it is really sort of, I have a spiritual practice, but it was God knocking, or my higher self knocking at the door, and an invitation to wake up to a better way of life. And I think about the 50 million people in this country suffering from chronic pain. And I wish I could reach all of them and say, there's nothing wrong with you. It's just time to wake up. And there's ways. It's like, there's a way out. So anyway, so then I went to this, or I Zoomed with this lovely woman and the rheumatologist. And she said, and she actually started asking me about my history, my traumas, my history, what I'd been through. She said, really honestly, my ACE scores, early childhood adversity, whatever. She said, you're a poster child for pain, chronic pain in later life. And there was something in me that was like, okay, so I'm not a failure at life, maybe, because when you are in a lot of physical pain, there's definitely, at least for me, this sense of, well, I'm mortified because I'm really broadcasting that I can't even figure out how to live sanely or healthfully. And the idea that I wasn't doing something wrong, that this was sort of a natural response to a lot of chaos and tumult in my life, and how I had adapted or maladapted to it, and that this was all coming to the surface, something in me just felt validated that I needed. And then, but And I was hoping for more. And she gave me low-dose naltrexone. Anyway,
Naltrexone?
Yeah, another medication, which I got and I never tried it. I'm like, I can't. I know that this is not, that I knew that medication was not going to be the solution. So I kept on looking and that's the thing is that I did find. In I think November, I found a clinic up in Northern California, and this doctor filled me with fluids and IVs. He said, your immune system is so shot that you can't even reboot. Like you need support, physiological support, which he gave me. And then he gave me my first kind of hybrid. If the kitty's bothering, let me know.
No, I can't hear it. No.
Okay. He gave me my first IV, ketamine IV, which for chronic pain, the IV is just extraordinary. And I'll be very brief because this is not your area, but it gave me a reprieve from myself for an hour where I was out of pain and I was out of fight and flight.
Yes.
And just my nervous system just being able to go, oh my God, there's a different point of reference. I felt like there is a me that is vast, that is intact, beyond all trauma, beyond all abuse, that can never be broken, that will always be intact. And from that place, that instant, I was able to completely reset my mind from hopelessness and despair to hope, and I got this is going to be a no-brainer. Only I can do this. Only I can connect the dots. Only I know all the moments, all of my experiences. I accessed my own inner healer. And from there, the floodgates opened. Yes.
So let me talk for a moment about ketamine, because I know, Catherine, it's like a big part of what you're doing now. And I know that classically, obviously, I am a mind-body practitioner. So I don't personally prescribe or direct people to do any sort of drug-assisted therapy. But having said that, I actually think there's an important bridge that we can build in this moment, which is that I am a big proponent of your perception is your reality. So your nervous system doesn't have anything except your conscious and unconscious input to tell it if you are safe or not. Once the nervous system determines if you're safe or not, that's when we have let's say you're unsafe, a heightened chronic fight or flight state, which means that the nervous system is consistently sending the brain messages of unsafety, of threat to survival. The brain in that moment is looking to keep you alive and so needs to divert you from the predator. So if the brain perceives your repressed emotional world as a greater predator than your physical pain, what happens in that moment of sustained fight or flight, the messages are sent to the brain and the brain sends inflammation, muscle constriction, muscle spasm, neuropathy, all the things that we feel in the human body that cause us discomfort. But then, as I often say, pain is not inherently bad. Pain is information and it's strong stimulation. And so the reason that I like what you're saying and the reason why, although I don't personally directly involve myself in drug-assisted therapy, I believe in it is because what you just said, for 1 hour, you had a break from being yourself. And we are so attached to our stories and our fear that is connected to our stories that if you can't have a brief respite in whatever way, whether it be a spiritual awakening or sitting beside a waterfall or on ketamine or in a deep therapy session or in a journal speak session, you know, however you get there, until you have that one pause, it is really hard to stop that reflexive, habitual story and fear that is keeping the nervous system up here, that is keeping it connecting to the brain and sending these signals of distress. And so I just wanted, because I do know that, you know, later on in the interview, we will talk more about what you're doing. And I know it involves ketamine. And I just wanted to kind of, because I've never on the podcast or publicly spoken of my stance on drug-assisted therapy. And I actually, I felt like it was important to sort of say it here. So
thank you very much. And it needs to be therapy because this is about.
Yes, this is not about doing drugs.
No, quite frankly, because this is about setting a very strong intention to really heal and to find the truth, to access the truth of yourself, because the brokenness is not the truth and the pain is not the truth. So it's just, they were just helping hands to get me in the right direction. So from there, I would say just with a shift in mindset to one of hopefulness, and openness, everything opened up. All these healing modalities, and you were one of them. And I read your book, and I found you on Instagram. And I, first of all, you have an amazing, you're incredibly articulate as far as mind-body issues. And I love your Instagram. I just, every time I see a post, I want to ask you if I can please copy and paste it and like put it up everywhere.
Of course.
On my website and all of these other places, because you're so relatable. You really are. So I just want to acknowledge that. You're a very, very, very important part of my recovery. And actually, I was thinking about this as I started to heal and get in touch with sort of what the pain really meant and what it was about and how incredibly full of rage I was, to breaking point, that every part of my body felt like it was on fire. So that's like my whole body was consumed with absolute rage. And the level of honesty that I started to get to is that if my kids would walk in and I was dealing with something or they were annoying me or whatever, I would say, you know, I have an anger problem. That was completely new language for me. I really didn't think I had an anger problem. So, and I think this is a big issue for women in general, especially I was brought up in England. I'm American, but I spent 10 years of my childhood in England, and the culture is very repressed, to say the least. At least I don't know now, but when I'm almost 62, so this was in the 60s and the 70s. And I was brought up a certain way, which was sort of, those were the times. And I was not encouraged to express emotion. And so my body found an outlet, and I learned to somatize everything. And I had, and this is like, I was talking about those different phases of the story. When I started to reflect and go back to my childhood, I went, oh my God, I have been symptomatic my entire life, from chronic stomach aches to headaches to UTIs, cystitis, all sorts of things, nonstop symptoms. And I literally, from a child, for being out of breath, I couldn't even run 200 meters without hyperventilating. It makes me sad, because I really thought there was something wrong with me and that I was weak and I was always being made fun of. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, those early childhood beliefs about that there was something wrong with me, which definitely, and my whole life was constructed with a confirmation bias to prove that that was the case.
Yeah.
So everything in my life always proved that was true. So that's something that I'm really free of. And so I started journaling, and I realized that, wow, when I got in touch with that little girl, which the whole concept of right brain versus left brain, and that the body is the expression of my subconscious, was revelatory to me, because it connect. Once I was understanding the relationship between mind and body, and that there was both the symptom was both a distraction but also a communication, and I started to understand like the dynamics of the subconscious. I was completely and utterly fascinated that I could have volcanic rage at the people that I loved simultaneously, that one didn't negate the other, that they could coexist in the subconscious. And at the level of my subconscious not being able to resolve the issue, it would turn into a physical symptom, because it's like, I don't know how to deal with that. So let's just, which is the mentality of a child that doesn't know how to integrate and embrace opposites as both as being possible, sort of the nuance of life, basically. So then I think when I spoke to you, and ultimately you didn't have time to be my therapist, but I knew that as I started to communicate with my body and invite my body to share what the pain was about, so there was a dialogue, and that dialogue freed me to a level of intimacy, to a level of intuition, to a level of respect and appreciation, that my body turned from this complex sort of antagonistic relationship to me, like loving my body and being so grateful and understanding that my body had been championing me, that these were boundaries that I'd never learned to say no for myself. So my body was saying no for me.
Yes.
Everything, it was like such a beautiful language and such a deep communion with myself that I think I didn't even know it was possible. And it really is through this work that I have learned and am continuing to learn a completely new way of living. One where I have so much control over my symptoms. I'm so empowered. I feel so autonomous in so many ways. And in a way, I feel like so many of us, and for me for sure, outsourcing my pain, my recovery, looking for answers outside was that frantic little child struggling with insecure attachment, looking for that paternal, maternal answer, looking for somebody to fix me outside of myself that knew better than me. And ultimately, that framework has imploded because the truth is, I do have the answers. And my body is constantly speaking to me. And if I just give myself the time of day and slow down a little bit and listen with deepest respect and reverence, the answer comes. And it comes fast. In the beginning, I thought it was BS that, you know, to ask the body just to reveal what the symptom meant, what it was trying to communicate in a way that was clear to me. That was sort of one of my exercises. And I didn't believe that there was going to be a response. But it got more and more fluent to the point that I would just pose the question and immediately I would get a picture in my mind or a symbol or an actual complete sentence. And my now fiance, he said, his commentary to me, seeing me go through this whole journey is, I think with my body is how he describes that. I thought that was such a perceptive.
Wow. That's fascinating. I want to rewind just a touch, and I want to bring a little bit of clarity to this process of communicating with one's body, because whenever I'm interviewing someone, I'm always listening on two levels. I'm listening as the me who's listening to you, and I'm listening as the newcomer. And so the one thing I want to say, what Catherine is saying is, wouldn't it be nice, right? Wouldn't it be nice if we could all flip a switch and have this great, incredible, clear dialogue with our bodies? And it is available to you. And the bridge between wouldn't it be nice and it being available to you is journal speak. And the reason why I say that, and of course there are other bridges, but I found it to be just such an effective technique, because what happens is, similar to anyone you don't know well, you have to get to know each other. And you really need to get to know yourself. And there are places in yourself that have never been revealed to you because it has just been too dangerous. It was too dangerous to draw boundaries. It was too dangerous to speak your mind. It was too dangerous to have needs. It was too dangerous to have feelings, you know, whatever your story is. And so as you start a journal speak practice and you make your lists and you start this sort of replacing fear with curiosity and delving within, you get to know this person. And now what happens when you know someone intimately? They trust you and you trust them. And so what ends up happening is this lovely moment that Catherine is describing, and I have it too, which I know, you know, leagues of people that have it too. So I know it's not unique, is that like, I'll get a pain because there is no cure for the human condition and there's no cure for human pain, but there is a cure for chronic pain, because chronic pain is an epidemic of fear and meaning and a misunderstanding between your brain, your nervous system, and your body. And so I will get a symptom, whether it be, you know, I've got like a bunch of common visitors, you know, I get the headache, I get the low back sort of achy, like it almost feels like I have period cramps in my back, not acute pain, but I'll get like a little gentle ache. I'll get a stomach ache, just random bizarre shit. But anyway, whenever it comes to visit, the first thing I do is I calm down, I pause, and I say, wow, looks like I have not been doing enough work. And it's just delightful. Like it's there's no shame. There's no blame. There's no argument between me, myself, and I. It's just a tacit understanding that clearly I'm up to here and I need to get a bit, you know, a few inches down. So that's the first thing that happens. The second thing that happens is I immediately swoop in with tremendous self-compassion. How have I found my way to that? A ton of journal speak, a ton of talking to the people that are doing this, a ton of being in community with people that are doing this, because I used to immediately hate myself for anything I saw as a weakness or an imperfection. So it's like those old voices might come up. Another thing you'll often hear me say is, you are not responsible for your first reaction to anything. Your first reaction, which is always a feeling. You are responsible if you mistreat someone. Some people have asked me that question. It's not about mistreating. You're not responsible for your first reaction. If you swell with rage, if you burst into tears, if you feel the need to walk away, That's a reflex. You can't control how you respond in the moment, but you are indeed responsible for your second reaction, which is usually an action. How are you going to respond back? How are you going to talk to yourself? You know, what the Buddhists call the second arrow. Are you going to sling the second arrow? If the first arrow is a made a mistake, the second arrow is, and you're a piece of shit, you know, are you going to sling the second arrow? So all of these things are modes of communication between me and myself, between my inner child and myself. And when you learn and when you spend time honoring that relationship and giving it the time and space it deserves, that's when you land where Catherine has landed, where I live, which is a picture can come up. You can see. So now that I've kind of said that, because I do want to always give enough explanation for someone who might look at you and say, and which is, this is why I always want to avoid, oh, well, Catherine's special. You know, she obviously has this down pat and she's better at this than me. And she can just have a conversation with her body and immediately she gets a picture. Trust me, I know this woman. This has not been an overnight sensation for her. She did the work and you can too.
Thank you, Nicole. When I actually spoke to you in the beginning, I was still in a lot of pain and I still have symptoms today and they move around.
Yep.
And I'm onto them and I talk to them and I'll negotiate. I'm like, you know what? I'm not really feeling like I want a giant migraine today. So can we, you know, I appreciate you working so hard on my behalf, but I really got this. How about we try something else and then I'll get an earache or something. So
hilarious.
It moves around. So a couple of things that came up for me that I wanted to mention is this, the writing, the journal speak, and really the free associating, which is allowing my subconscious to just reveal itself on the page. And you do something remarkable that's a little bit different than a lot of the other journaling exercises, this kind of wrap up. And so I'll write, it will take me somewhere very often to a younger memory, sort of where I felt the same thing before. And then I'll go back and I'll be able to repair that. And this is not always the case, but very often there's an origin story to this pain. And I'll go to it and I'll unlock it and I'll show up for myself in the past. And I'll champion myself in a way that I wasn't able to do for myself. And I'll also get in touch with a part of myself that rejected myself in that moment.
Yes.
Because somehow I was the problem that didn't have the resources to resolve whatever was going on that was painful. And it was almost as if with that part of my psyche, I cut my losses. I said, hey girl, I'm not thrilled to be you because you're not really helping me out too much. And so I'm just going to cut you loose and leave you behind. But those frozen, I really believe this from the work that I've gotten to do, those parts of ourselves are frozen in time. And every time I take the time to go back and resolve it myself, I free up a lot. I free up energy. I free up wisdom. I free up experience that I become more resourceful and I become more integrated and whole. It's almost like I'm bringing back pieces of myself. So I don't know if that makes sense. And the other thing, my internal dialogue, I love this when you talk about, like, my little girl has like an arsenal in my head. And when I'm now aware of when I get triggered and how angry I am, and in the beginning, everything triggered me. When I was like, my nerves were on fire, you opened the door the wrong way, I was flaring.
Right.
So I really got in touch with like everything in the beginning. I was so dysregulated that I was angry about absolutely everything. And I have an AK-47 in my head and I was blowing people up left, right, and center. And that's what I needed to do, was blow the crap out of everybody. And without them ever knowing.
Well, see, this is the thing though, that I really want to get across to people, especially people who have been brought up in cultures. And I guess in the UK is one of them, where we're taught to be so damn polite and to be quiet. And I know that there are many religious cultures that are like that and many different, societal expectations that go along with that. I cannot tell you how many times I have been in this very office where I sit and have had to go to town on my family in ways that sound so awful and so mean and so rejecting and so judgmental and so critical, because none of it is ever really about the other person. It's all about the places in me that feel like I'm failing people, or the places in me that feel like I'm over-identifying with somebody else's foibles, you know, whatever. And it can't begin with me, because that doesn't feel unsafe. So to just eviscerate people that I am, quote, supposed to love, who I do deeply love, and walking out of this office and back into my life and truly having my open arms to put around them. I mean, it is stunning. It's improved every relationship in my life. It has created my ability to be successful as a parent and have this incredible relationship with my three teenagers. Like, it's opened me to love and relationship in ways that I never had imagined I could be so happy. All of that stuff is because we don't repress that which is so human and natural. It's okay to hate and rage at the people you love, because it's never as simple as just being angry at another person. We are working out shit within us that needs to be worked out, that is essential. And if we don't do it, it will manifest through our bodies, you know, and it's just the bottom line. So I love the way you're describing it.
Well, thank you. I would say that this work is the antithesis of a spiritual bypass. And yes. I had decades doing all forms of spirituality, including I'm a long-term meditator, probably from 1986. And pretty much most spiritual practices involve some form of transcendence.
Yeah.
You have to get beyond the earthly realm. You have to move away from negative emotions. Like, there's a tremendous emphasis on disowning that which is negative, you know, whether it's You know what I'm talking about.
No, I mean, it's what I always write about, you know, turn the page, get over it, you know, lighten up, look on the bright side. You know, it's all such crap. And it's the reason that people are sick.
So the level of honesty with realizing that I am the good, the bad, and the ugly, and my humanity is my Freudian id, is my Jung shadow, is my dark side. And as long as I am honest with myself about how things really impact me and what's really going on inside, then the way that I interface with reality is far more potent, because it's as if I have birthed a voice that I never knew I had, that is more direct, that is not that nice. I really thought I was a very nice person. And I have come to as I learned to get to know myself better, I'm not particularly nice. I'm much ruder than I ever knew. And in this relationship, my significant other is on the receiving end of this quite different person. But the one thing that I want to say that is important to me, the way that I relate with pain today, because it doesn't mean that I'm symptom free, but I'm not afraid when I have a symptom. Even if a completely new one pops up, I'm like, oh, this is a different flavor. My relationship with my internal dialogue is, I don't like how this feels.
Yes.
This doesn't feel good to me. And that could be my pain. That could be something that somebody says to me. That could be the way that my kid slams the door. It's relational. But ultimately, that little girl who's saying, whose voice I hear today, which is the biggest miracle of all, because before it was just static and pain. Now I hear like a voice going, I don't like how this feels. And I get to step in and go, I know it really is not easy right now, is it? But there's nothing wrong with you. And you're not in any danger. And I got you, girl. I'm here for you. I got your back. I'm not leaving. And that kind internal dialogue that I now am able to apply to my parenting, even though my kids are 19, 21, and 31, that's how I show up as a mom today, with a kind voice that is understanding, that's not trying to fix, that's not trying to get people past a certain point. It's just this ability to just accept. And I didn't have the ability to communicate like that before. It just didn't exist. It is like learning a new language.
It is indeed. And I want to say something about you saying that you're not as nice as you thought. I just can't agree with that. And I'm going to tell you why. I'm going to tell you why. Because, okay, the reason I wrote my book and I named it The Meaning of Truth is because as I was sitting trying to sort of meditate on the years that I had been in practice helping people move through this, I was like, what is the biggest barrier to our understanding how to be well? And it kept coming up that we are too hard and fast with definitions. We define things like this is what it means to be sick. This is what it means to be somebody's daughter. This is what it means to be somebody's mother. This is what it means to be an angry person, right? Like we define it. And then I thought to myself, well, what's our really most troublesome definition? And the definition is the definition of truth. What is it to tell the truth? Is I love you the truth? Is I hate you the truth? Is I'm scared the truth? Is you confuse me the truth? Is I'm okay the truth? And the truth is, it is all of them and often at the same time. And I had to get people to pause and consider the meaning of truth, but also the meaning of everything. Because if I sit here and say, I hate being a mother, and I'm screaming inside, is that the truth? Well, in that very moment that can be as fleeting as a second, it is. And how can I get into my pain? How can I get into the place that will transform me and heal? Only through that door. So if I say motherhood is really hard, if I say I'm really tired, if I say, of course I love my children, they're just a little spirited, you know, yes, those are also all true. But if I can't in that moment completely devolve and say, I hate this. I'm not doing it. I can't stand it. I'm running away. I give up. I quit. I'm done. If I can't say that, I miss the door. So I'm banging into the walls. I'm like the video game character where it keeps banging into the wall. Like the door to everything that will set you free is through these very challenging truths that we are taught not to say. So what is it to be nice? I think you are lovely. I think you are loving and kind and thoughtful. And I don't know what it means to be nice, but I know that the definition that you are saying you are not is a definition built on falsehoods and propriety and shoulds. And I think we all get sick of shoulding all over ourselves. And I guess I'm always looking to live in the gray because it's so important for everyone listening to be able to hear stuff like that.
Okay, so perhaps I'm not as polite as I thought it was. Okay, should we say polite?
Yes.
Okay. Because that's totally the truth. I'm like, the things that come out of my mouth these days, I shock myself constantly. I really do. But inside I'm laughing. I'm like, oh my God, this is my real personality finally coming out.
Well, we're all a little bit too polite.
Yeah.
Or we're taught to be, at least. You know why? Because polite people are convenient and polite children are easy for exhausted parents and for embarrassed parents and for parents that were shamed into thinking they have to do everything perfectly. And, you know, honestly, we could all do well to wake up a lot to that.
So going back to the journey of recovery, which I wish I could say was an overnight success, but I'm not. It took years. It took 2 years. I mean, in the beginning, all of a sudden I would have a day without pain. And that was, oh my God, just the experience of moving, the gratitude that I had for just one day. I mean, really, that was extraordinary. And then the pain would come back, but I never fell into the same level of hopelessness and despair because I had touched a place where I knew it was possible. And I just kept moving towards that. And I went through everything that you talk about from a symptom imperative, that the symptoms would move around like crazy. It got worse before it got better. It was like the pattern was really acting out and get it sort of to the 11th degree in terms of it didn't want to die.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, I still had challenges, but then I would get 2 days, then a week. But it took, I would say, repatterning my brain and my thinking and the way that I was doing life and making things making things crystal clear, like just the dialogue and what was going on with my nervous system and understanding the way I responded to everything was sort of immediate, an immediate inflammatory response. It was the whole thing was an education. And where are we now? At the 3-year mark. And today, if I had a symptom right now, I would barely even notice it.
Yeah.
Really would. It's extraordinary. It doesn't define me anymore. I would say in the worst part of the pain, it defined me.
Yeah.
And everything was filtered through the lens of, can I handle this? Can I handle going to a movie? Because I can't sit in a chair for 2 hours. Everything, my life got so small, so fast. And I felt so ashamed of myself for being somebody, you know, and ashamed to go to doctors because of just feeling like that problem person.
Yeah.
Probably feeling like that problem child. I mean, that whole.
Yeah. It all resonates through us.
Yeah.
So I want everyone to know, since you can only hear Catherine and you can't see her, her fingers are beautiful and long and not swollen. And she's looking fantastic. And I'm just so thrilled. Your story is so powerful. I really love hearing it. It really actually brought a ton of clarity to it to hear it today. Now, I know you are involving yourself in some really exciting stuff. I actually don't know where it is at the latest. So why don't you share with us a little bit of what you're doing now that has evolved essentially from your healing journey?
100%. I feel like I've been given a second lease on life. And with that comes this incredible zest to want to share, because I know how hard it was for me to find these solutions. They're not handed over in the beginning. If anything, it's very few doctors still that know that these modalities are available and actually work. So I really want to use all of my ability, my media relationships to get this information out there as best as I can. So one thing my eldest daughter and I, that's India, and I did is that we spent the last year and a half building a website, a platform called Helix 180. That's H-E-A-L-I-X 180.
Ah, Helix 180. Helix. And I will have, I'll put the link in the show notes.
Thank you, sweetie. And the point of that was really sort of a resource hub for people who were struggling with symptoms of PTSD. And I'm going to tell you, it took a year and a half because it was really hard to explain these concepts to people that you assume don't know nothing, don't even know that a symptom of PTSD could be chronic pain. So that's been a struggle for us to try and to figure out how to articulate so that people can find solutions. And so we have a whole section on mind body, and you are one of the people that we are happily promoting, and you know, hope that your work reaches even more people so that you can help. And then the other side of the website is more towards the psychedelic with or without medicine angle. And what else are we doing on our website? So yes, it's just a landing page, basically about a mother and a daughter who have gone through hell together, both separately, have come together, both on their journeys of recovery from various forms of PTSD, and have found solutions. And it has deepened our relationship. It has brought us back. It has brought us more deeply together, also with the understanding of how transgenerational pain perpetuates, seeing how what happened to her was almost like she was a pattern completion for me of those areas of trauma that were unresolved for me. She then took up the baton,
yes,
and part of her life seemed to be unconsciously dedicated to resolving some of my traumas and how that happens, which is absolutely fascinating. So
wild.
So it's really, and also on the website, we're not promoting, but we talk about the foundation, which is my nonprofit, and we want to help especially women who are survivors of sexual trauma, who are struggling with symptoms of PTSD. And so we hosted a retreat back in March. All the women were cult survivors, some of them third and fourth generation with a lot of abuse.
Yeah.
And most of them for 11 days, we put them through a ketamine assisted therapy program that we designed. and with 6 months of continuing care. And we've now been approached by an organization called Heroic Hearts to collaborate to help women who have suffered military combat, female combat veterans who have suffered military sexual violence. Wow. And I hope that we are funded. I funded the first one. I don't have any, you know, I can't fund everything, but right. I want to help women, especially women are the largest population of people struggling with PTSD. And a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah.
So, you know, on this journey, I want to try and integrate the psychedelic angle, which gives you an access point, like an immediate, it's a catalyst. So it takes you out of, it helps you from a neurobiological standpoint, help your brain get out of the ruts.
Yes, the hamster wheel of the story, yes.
So you have the psychedelic, very often I think, and this explains Stockholm syndrome, why do women go back to abusive relationships? Not because they're weak of character, not because psychologically they're impaired, but because they're neurobiologically wired to crave that thing. Yeah. So the psychedelic in this case will, especially ketamine, because it impacts the glutamate system, will actually feed your neuronal circuits, feed your brain, allow your neurons to regrow and heal and reverse whatever happens to your brain because of trauma. Will yeah. actually help your brain repair, which gives you a head start as far as like moving beyond.
Right. So I love the idea of a head start because it's a pause and a head start because, you know, I imagine you'll agree with me. No medicine, no drug, no therapy, no intervention, no procedure can make anybody quote well. It is a doorway. It is an opportunity. It is a leg up. But the work is ours. And that's such difficult news to deliver sometimes. You know, it's a really two-pronged message. You know, part of it is celebratory, because if the work is yours, it means you can do it. And oh my goodness, the power is back in your hands. And part of it is a drag, because if the work is mine, oh God, now I have to do it. And so I know, you know, we just returned from Omega a couple of weeks ago. We had an incredible retreat. And it's like, people there, I watch them celebrate and mourn at the same time, the fact that the work is ours. But I love that you guys are doing this to get the word out and having these retreats and your incredible foundation. I really encourage anyone out there who's interested in supporting this cause to go over to helix180.com and to help, because this is an incredibly worthy cause. And I myself, as a woman who is so behind helping women, did not know that women are the largest group of PTSD survivors, but it makes so much sense. It's just that when you hear PTSD, at least for me, my first thing I think of is combat veterans, of course, who also deserve, you know, all of our empathy and our care. And I think that's mostly men, but you're right. If you think about sexual trauma, if you think about just the things that women have to put up with in this life, that makes a hell of a lot of sense.
Now, just to add, whatever curriculum we are in the process of designing right now, we want to integrate the mind-body work, because there's nobody doing trauma work that is integrating mind-body work. And I think that we're going to see exponential results. So that's exactly what I'm trying to figure out, is to how to design a mind-body program to accompany from the therapeutic standpoint.
Well, we're all, you know, we're a small but mighty group of people that are carrying this message, and I know it will continue to build and build worldwide. Catherine Oxenberg, thank you so much for being with us today.
Nicole, you're amazing. Thank you so much.
Amazing. All right, everybody. Well, if you are enjoying this podcast, please hop over to iTunes and rate and review it. It helps people all over find the podcast. And until next time, this has been Nicole Sachs with the Cure for Chronic Pain podcast, and I will see you then. Bye-bye.